A warning for listeners. This episode contains brief mentions of violence and language that may be inappropriate for some audiences. It's late spring 1980 in Cuba. A 22-year-old Osvaldo Durruti is sitting on a bus, making his way across the country from a prison cell in Santiago de Cuba to the port of Mariel. He's getting his first taste of freedom in years, but this bus ride is anything but relaxing. Long term, he doesn't entirely understand what his future holds. Short term, he's worried about the bottles that protesters are throwing at his bus, worried they could bust through his window.
There were people in the street throwing bottles of beer and sodas and egg, throwing, "Get out here! Get out! Que se vaya! No lo queremos!"
These protesters consider him a traitor, since he was one of the nearly 125,000 Cubans who were leaving their homes, hospital rooms, or prison cells and fleeing to the United States as part of the Mariel boat lift.
Osvaldo's bus eventually made it through the protesters and to the port of Mariel, where hundreds, if not thousands, of people were waiting to get on boats.
What was that like?
Oh, my goodness. It was full of people. Mm-hmm. Full of Cuba. All ages, niños, mujeres, hombres, todo el mundo, sin ropa, sin... Yo tenía la ropa de la prisión.
An image of chaos, boys, women, and men, people without clothes or wearing their clothing from prison.
There were a lot of boats in the Mariel. Thousands of boats, all kinds of boats, little boats, swing boats, balsas.
Osvaldo watched these boats for a whole day, wondering which one would take him to his new home.
So we wait for the depart. It was supposed to be a siren. Mm. Wah, 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 to go to the park. And so, you know, when the time came, you know, all kind of boats depart, you know, Mariel, all kind of boats. I'm talking about thousands.
I just can't even imagine. It's so hard to fathom.
Although the scene was chaotic and unlike anything he'd experienced, Osvaldo was excited. He had no clue, standing on these shores of Cuba, that he was about to step into a life that is, at times, unbelievable.
And you're going to be shocked to hear what I'm going to say later. Huh?
Soy Omar Granados.
And I'm Maureen McCollum. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Uprooted. In this episode, people who left Cuba come to the United States as part of the Mariel boat lift and share their experiences with us. Their exodus got a lot of media coverage, which we'll talk about later in this episode. But these exiles who lived through it, they talk about their journey across the sea and their first memories of stepping ashore in Florida. People like Osvaldo Durruti, who now lives in Madison, Wisconsin. When he was 7 years old, Osvaldo started his first business. He was a budding entrepreneur in his hometown of Santiago de Cuba, armed with a skill his mother taught him.
We had to do laundry every day, and we do it by hands. And I became so good washing and ironing that the whole neighborhood had to deal with me because they said, "You're too good, and we're going to pay you to wash our clothes and to iron our clothes."
Osvaldo became known as the laundryman. This job was a big deal, not only because he still, to this day, loves ironing his clothes, but because it was foundational. It laid the groundwork for always thinking ahead when it came to survival. What was his next job? What was his next hustle? Even at 7, Osvaldo had to make money for his family. His father died when he was young, so his mother was trying to raise 2 kids on her own.
Norca. Yeah, I'm proud of her because, you know, she was a, you know, good mother. You know, we didn't go to sleep hungry, ever. You know, she teach me how to iron clothes, how to wash clothes. She was the mother any child wished to have, except that, you know, don't make her angry. Like the kids, be raised different than America. In Cuba, the parents, they put a hanks, they beat them out. They beat their child, you know. So I grew up with my mama beating me up, you know, a lot. I was abused as a child, you know. That is something that, you know, I carry with me.
Eventually, the neighborhood's laundryman needed something that would pay better. Osvaldo turned to pickpocketing, which eventually landed him in prison.
Yeah, I was in prison for a carterista, pickpocket. Mm. I was good, you know, doing that. Awesome, was good. But, you know, everything got, you know, sooner or later, you know, you're going to be busted, you know, doing wrong thing.
And it is revealing that he says he was good at it. He sees pickpocketing as a trade, showing the lack of opportunities that Black people had in Cuba during the revolution. And one reason why they turned to petty crimes is because food rations were not enough to feed their families.
So as Osvaldo is sitting in prison for pickpocketing, he hears about the situation at the Peruvian embassy.
News about the Mariel boat lift traveled fast across the island. It wasn't just being talked about in Havana.
He got the news for all over Cuba that, you know, people were jumping in the embassy in La Habana. Mm-hmm. In Havana, Cuba, people were jumping in the embassy. So, you know, everybody wanted to come. Everybody trying to buy that they can reach out to Havana.
A friend of Osvaldo's convinced him to go to the United States. So he left prison in Santiago de Cuba and got on a bus to Havana on the opposite end of the island.
And the only people who got buses to get to Havana were us, you know, the inmates. Castro, he put buses from all the Cuban penitentiary to come, and all the, of course, he convenient, you know, he don't want, you know, these the people he don't want there, you know. So he's saying, you know, all these people, you know, truly Mariel.
Fidel Castro is allowing prisoners like Osvaldo, as well as Enrique, Erne, Niño, and Armando to join the crowds at Mariel, people who are trying to leave Cuba. But he didn't stop there.
Here's Lillian Guerra, author and professor of Cuban and Caribbean history at the University of Florida.
Non-revolutionaries. On May 1st, he would say that there was a genetic defect that made them non-revolutionaries. They're genetically deficient, so they need to get out.
And that wasn't the only inflammatory remark from Castro's now famous speech that day.
He who has no revolutionary genes, he who has no revolutionary blood, he who does not have a mind that adapts to the idea of the revolution, he who does not have a heart that can adapt to the effort of heroism required by a revolution, we do not want them, we do not need them. No los queremos, no los necesitamos. A very famous speech, we don't want them, we don't need them. A moment in the history of Cuba where the revolution is really resetting its course to redefine who is going to be part of society and who is not.
Only about 40% of the people who left through Mariel were actually picked up by relatives. The rest self-registered. You had to do that by going to your police station and saying you wanted to leave, and then you needed to give evidence of the fact that you were not a revolutionary. So you could do that by self-confession. You could say, I'm a lesbian, my daughter is a whore, my husband's gay, and all of us want to leave. And that's literally what you did. And you got a certificate, which is your pass from the police station, that identified you as an antisocial. And identified you often with these degrees of detail. You could argue that you ran a bordello out of your house. That would get you, you know, out.
No one was fact-checking whether you were actually a lesbian or running a bordello out of your home.
Oh, no. And it was part of the whole, you know, dynamic of legitimating the Mariel boat lift from the perspective of Fidel Castro was to encourage people to self-demonize. You know, if Fidel is saying the only people who want to leave this fabulously perfect or perfecting society of great equality and wonderful liberation, if the only people who want to leave are lumpens and, you know, escoria, human trash, they are non-revolutionaries.
There is no path out of the country unless you mark yourself as a criminal.
And many people were stunned because the folks who went out and said they were human trash and that they were gay and had been running a bordello for years were highly respected members of their society. You know, they were doctors, they were lawyers. They were, you know, it was the case that 90% were working class, but there were plenty of working class people who were very, very esteemed members of their society. They were the ones who admitted that they had just been faking it, or that they had just finally been able to get out and they wanted to give their kids a different life than the one that had been chosen for them.
So back to the port of Mariel, where people like Osvaldo Durruti, a.k.a. the laundryman, are boarding boats. They're leaving behind the only home they've ever known, Cuba, for the United States. Some of these soon-to-be exiles were told to just hop aboard a boat. It was a free ride. But some passengers were specifically trying to get to their family in the U.S., and some of those aunts, grandfathers, cousins, and parents living in the U.S. were paying captains thousands of dollars to pick their Cuban relatives up.
These scenarios are just part of the reason that the scene at the port was absolute chaos.
Two of the people who are at the port of Mariel are now Wisconsinites and current roommates in La Crosse, two guys we heard from in previous episodes, Ernesto Rodriguez and Rodosvaldo Pozo. Erne was one of those people who was put on a boat after being released from prison.
There was not big boat, but there was a fishing boat.
A fishing boat with about 80 people on board. Rodosvaldo Pozo, or Nino, was in prison from the alleged sugarcane burning incident. He was also released from prison during the Mariel boat lift. Once he arrived at the port, someone directed him to a boat.
They got a big boat, Cuban fishing boat. It's with me, come on. So I went with it.
But the trip across the Florida Strait would be traumatic for Nino and Edney.
Well, there was a scary in the middle of the sea. Oh my God. We got a lot of people there, baby crying and stuff. And I see a boat behind me that went down all the way. There it come out.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God, I was so scared.
The ocean in the beginning was calm. But when we was in the middle of the ocean, that's when they started. And that's when a lot of boats sink, people drown.
How did you feel?
Scared. See the big wave. The boat was top like this, and when it was going down like this, it was. And people scared, people get sick, everybody.
Osvaldo Durruti, the laundryman, also survived a devastating boat ride. During his journey from Cuba to the United States, he sat at the front of a huge shrimping boat.
We left in the morning, like 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning, something like that. Around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we had to cross, you know, El Paso de los Vientos, Golfo de México, todo eso, que eso estaba bien, bien violento. Entonces, ahí donde empieza la cosa, empieza los botes, and that is when the sharks come in.
The waters became violent. The boat was rocking. Osvaldo could see sharks swimming in the water, surrounding them. And it was about to get really bad.
People jumping, people falling from the boat, and the shark eating.
People falling off your boat?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
I had a friend of mine who lost his leg.
Oh, my gosh.
He got a helicopter, you know, on top.
This was likely the U.S. Coast Guard, whose forces were patrolling the waters to rescue people who fell over or were packed on overcrowded boats.
From the helicopter, they throw, you know, ladders, you know, and I see a friend of mine who left in a different boat. He was in the same penitentiary. He was racing out without one leg, you know, blood all over, you know, and the ocean was all red. Too many shark eating, feeding. And so, you know, there were those who made it. There were those who not. Guess what? I made it. I made it.
Thankfully.
Thanks God. I made it. So, you know.
I'm so sorry you went through that.
Coast Guard officials fear there may be dozens, perhaps even hundreds of boats adrift in the Florida Straits without radios, unable to contact rescuers. While 14 empty boats have been found by the Coast Guard, Cuban Americans in Key West assisting in the boat lift feel that any Cubans adrift...
News reports say that 27 people died while crossing the Florida Straits during the Mariel boat lift, but some believe many more drowned. There just are not official records to prove it. In fact, there's a lot of information we don't know about because we don't have access to the official Cuban documentation or archives. For the Cuban scholarship and Cuban American scholarship that has attempted to reconstruct the full story of Mariel, this is the biggest challenge. There's plenty of information what happened on the Key West side, but when it comes to the Cuban side, we have to rely on personal stories, the accounts of those who were there.
Stories from people like Nino, Erne, and Osvaldo. So after a long, grueling boat ride, Cubans like Osvaldo Durruti eventually landed in Key West, Florida.
I was so glad to become to, you know, to be part of America. That was my dream. I remember when I was a little boy. So, you know, when I came to the United States, I was saying, hi, everybody. Yeah.
Ernesto Rodriguez was also ecstatic to get off the shrimping boat.
When I got to Key West, the soon I get out the boat, I kiss the ground and thank you,
they're
God.
They're resting right now. They're just all bone tired. If you see them arriving and coming off the bus, they're just dragging. They're really tired, really thin, and they just want to sleep and eat. That's why we are taking them to the dining halls to get them fed before we... before we do any in-processing on them.
Waiting for refugees like Osvaldo and Erne were volunteers and government officials handing out clothes and food, most notably, apples.
That was the first time we saw apple in my life. I eat apple.
What did you think of it?
Some people want to save it. I wanted to eat it. Some people just want to put it to La Virgen de la Caridad. Gracias, thank you. Thank you for, you know, letting me here. You know, I say, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You're right.
I love for my first time. So I say, man, this is good. This is what they call apple. First memory. What's my first memory?
Erne got two apples, something he hadn't eaten since 1964. To drink, he got something he'd only tried once in his life.
I went to with a Coca-Cola. I have one can, and I said, can I have one more? He said, yeah, one. You know, when you drink Coca-Cola, you cannot drink the whole thing. And then the guy said, I don't understand what he said. And he said, you're going to choke. And then I said, no comprendo. The first one, I drink like half, straight.
Yeah. Erne was then led to a mess hall. It was his first all-you-can-eat experience.
They said, there was a buffet. The guy said, you can eat whatever. And because we never see food like this. Everybody was, wow, that's America?
Good meal that day. They gave us chicken and macaroni and cheese and some stuff. And, you know, black eyed peas. And, you know, we had a blast. And the apple.
And the apple.
This was a big deal for Cubans coming from food rations in Cuba.
So the Cubans coming to the U.S. were eventually going to have to make a ton of adjustments. And it wasn't just getting used to new food, right, Omar?
Right. While many refugees had heard about the American dream, they'd never lived under capitalism. These all-you-can-eat buffets were just the first taste of that dream. They'd been taught to be socialist, so shifting to capitalism was hard. Most Mariel refugees were part of a population and a generation that needed to be educated in the ways of a capitalist society.
What do you mean by that?
You know, like learning about health insurance or how to use a credit card, how to buy a car. You go from a place where there's no private property, moving into a world where everything now is private. You're moving into a world where the state doesn't provide your food or your rations or your health insurance. More importantly, you go from having no options to suddenly having 100 types of different cereal. But it all comes at a cost. You have to have money and you have to have a job to be able to participate in that economy and buy that cereal.
And there had to be a language barrier too, right?
Correct. Most of them did not speak English at all. Mostly because they'd not been exposed to any American culture and English was not taught at schools at the time.
The Cuban refugees like Osvaldo, Erne, and Nino were having eye-opening experiences on the shores of Key West and in the processing centers.
But these discoveries came at a price.
After the break, as the Cubans arrive in Florida, they're gaining a lot of media attention. Not all of it is good. You're listening to Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Secret meetings, deleted documents, and a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The story behind Wisconsin's electoral maps is anything but boring. Hi, I'm Bridget Bowden, co-host of WPR Report's Mapped Out. It's an investigative podcast that gives you the lowdown on Wisconsin's redistricting past and what it means for its legislative future. Get the whole story and subscribe at WPR.org/mappedout or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Maureen McCullum. Thanks for joining me and my co-host, Omar Granados, on WPR Report's Uprooted. I'm honored to explore the historical account of thousands of Cubans who came to Wisconsin during the Mariel boatlift and interview exiles who have decided to share their stories. WPR is member-supported. That means your gift makes powerful storytelling, like we're hearing today, available to you and the entire state. Support this essential resource at WPR.org/donate. The moment the Cuban refugees stepped off the boats in Florida in 1980, they had people waiting for them, including refugee assistance groups, government agency workers, and journalists.
So on March 31st of 1980, I walked into the Miami Herald newsroom as an intern from the University of Florida. And I arrived to sort of a sea of men in white and blue and with a tinge of yellow shirts just, you know, swarming in the newsroom and maybe a few women.
That's Fabiola Santiago, a staff columnist with the Miami Herald. 3 weeks after she started her internship, the Mariel boatlift was underway.
All the stories that were coming forward were government officials say this, government officials say that. And I thought, well, what do the people say? You know, why don't they talk to the people? And so that kind of became my role, to talk to the Mariel refugees, to interview them, to seek them out.
Fabiola got her first front page story less than a month after she started, and it featured Mariel refugees.
This group of adolescents who had burst into the Peruvian embassy had now arrived in Miami on the Mariel boatlift, and they were at this lady's house in Coral Gables. And so I sat around with them and interviewed them, and they told me things about how they were in a Havana party. And all of a sudden, they heard about the Peruvian embassy, and they decided to just leave the party and storm the embassy. And so once they got in, if they left, then they couldn't leave Cuba. So they stuck it out, and they told me things about the fact that they caught a cat, they ate a cat. because 10,000 people jammed into this sort of mansion turned embassy, and they slept like on trees. There was no space. People were like packed shoulder to shoulder. And so it was a very detailed and amazing story.
Stacked ceiling high on Surnama Flores' back porch are brown bags filled with food and giant coolers with ice and cans of soda. Coming in and out of the house are friends, neighbors, and others Flores doesn't even know. They bring more food, more clothing, all for the 27 teenagers she is keeping in her two-bedroom home at 3652 Southwest 25th Street. The teenagers, ages 13 through 17, left their parents behind in Cuba. "All the ones who don't have relatives will stay with me," Flores said. "I'll give them love and understanding. I have enough for all of them."
Covering the Mariel boat lift became Fabiola's beat. She says she felt a connection with the Mariel refugees. She and her family had immigrated to Miami from Cuba in 1969 during the Freedom Flights.
I grew up in Matanzas, and the Mariel refugees, you know, were people who were, you know, laborers. They were just normal, everyday people versus the first wave of immigration that I came into here, which were basically made of wealthier Cubans, upper-class Cubans, professional Cubans. And so here were, like, truly the people. It was really the people's immigration, right? And that was very emotional for me. It was an emotional moment, right, of recognition of my culture.
But not every Cuban-American welcomed the new wave of immigrants as enthusiastically as Fabiola.
Michael Bustamante is associate professor of history and Emilio Bacardi Moreau chair in Cuban and Cuban-American studies at the University of Miami.
To put it bluntly, and to make a long story short, the Mariel refugees, even in the heart of the Cuban-American community that was already existing, were not received with the kind of open arms that the first cohorts of refugees had received in the early 1960s.
And if this is the reception some of the Mariel refugees are getting in Florida, where there's a sizable Cuban population, imagine how it goes in places where there aren't many Cubans, like Wisconsin.
Mike says the early Cuban refugees and the Mariel refugees came from the same country, yet completely different worlds. The early Cuban exiles were mostly professional, had money, were upper middle class, and white.
It's one thing to have left the island in 1961, 1962, when you've experienced, you know, 2 years of this thing called the revolution in power. It's quite another to have been educated under it or to have lived under it for 20 years, right? So the kinds of memories and experiences that people have under their belt, I think, are just different.
As for the rest of the U.S., the way they got to know the Marielitos over the years comes in part from Hollywood.
I'm Tony Montana, a political prisoner from Cuba, and I want my human right. There's nothing you can do to me that Castro has not already done.
Get him out of here!
And if you don't live in Miami, everything you know about Marielitos, you may have learned from Scarface.
Omar, you love talking about this movie.
Yes, the movie comes out only 3 years after the refugees have arrived, and we have a major Hollywood production with Al Pacino in the main role of Tony Montana, this ruthless, violent, one of the most violent characters perhaps that Hollywood has seen, played by an Italian-American actor who is trying to use a Cuban accent.
Do you want
to
play rough? Okay. To my little friend.
This is significant because it introduces the American public and a global audience to the image of a Mariel refugee as this uprooted, ruthless Latino gangster. This is a new stereotype that we're starting to see in Hollywood, who doesn't really value his relationships with his family. He's got difficulty relating to his sister and his mother, We don't see scenes like we see in The Godfather where, you know, the family gets together on Sunday for dinner. And this is a major change in the way in which we're talking about criminals in Hollywood. So for all of its box office success, this film also created a harmful stereotype and immediate backlash from the Cuban American community in South Florida.
The way the movie Scarface portrays Tony Montana isn't too different from the way the news media had portrayed many Mariel refugees.
There has been a great deal of concern and speculation here about the emigration of criminals from Cuban jails.
Look at their shoes, a Marine mutters as the long lines shuffle forward. They all have the same shoes, Cuban prison issue.
The White House will be issuing a statement that will make unambiguously clear this government's intention.
The Carter administration has threatened them with deportation.
Castro has taken hardened criminals out of prison and forced some of the boat owners who have gone to Cuba from our country to bring these criminals back to the United States. Thus far, over 400 such persons have been detained. I have instructed the Attorney General to commence exclusion proceedings immediately for these criminals and others who represent any danger to our country.
If any country will accept them, we'll be glad to deport them. It's as simple as that.
We're going to bring in another expert to talk about this.
My name is Jillian Marie Jacklin, and I have a PhD in history.
Jillian is a lecturer at UW-Green Bay. When she was getting her PhD in history at UW-Madison, she published a paper that examined the media coverage of Mariel refugees.
The way that the U.S. media portrayed it was that Castro was taking the opportunity to sort of get rid of quote-unquote scum or escoria, people who weren't doing great things, right? And so the U.S. media picked up on that and said that Castro was sort of releasing all of its criminals to the United States, and that the people were coming had sort of dangerous pasts. And also sexuality was a major component to this as well. So national media sort of took on that there were what we would call today maybe LGBTQ plus people coming from the island.
Jillian says there were a lot of mixed signals in the media's reporting of the refugees' arrival.
But then again, embedded within that message was that it was the responsibility, right, of the U.S. government and U.S. citizens to at least detain these people to show that, like, the U.S. is a democratic nation that would accept anybody, especially people wanting to flee communism, right? So it's within this global battle between communism and really capitalist democracy that these refugees are arriving.
And this media battle was a victory for Castro, since the U.S. press ate up everything he was saying about his own citizens. There was no way to verify, because there were no criminal records being shared or no medical records of the people that were coming. In a way, the U.S. media failed to dismantle the narrative that Castro had created.
It's bizarre, right, if this person named Fidel Castro is this awful dictator who does sort of everything wrong and in the opposite way that the U.S. government would do it, right? But like you're saying, then why would the U.S. national media then take everything that he's saying as at face value?
Again, Professor Lilian Guerra.
Of 124,779, no more than about 3,000 people were hardened criminals, people who were either, and when I say hardened criminals, I don't mean people who were murderers. I mostly mean people who committed some kind of a violent crime that's associated with the traditional categories of crime, like theft. But they start somewhere. You know, they start with some economic crime.
Yes, some dangerous people came to the U.S. via Mariel. But most of the people sent to the U.S. from Cuban prisons, people like Osvaldo, Armando, Nino, and Erne, were guilty of things like petty theft, smoking weed, being gay, and speaking ill of the communist government.
But the narrative that Mariel refugees could be dangerous was the one that took hold.
While U.S. immigration history is not exactly full of warm welcomes, the late 1970s are a time when the U.S. has already accepted several waves of Cubans, plus plenty of people from Southeast Asia who were fleeing conflicts. In March, President Jimmy Carter signed the Refugee Act of 1980 into law. It essentially opened the United States' doors to more refugees and also clarified some immigration policies. And in mid-April, Carter agreed to take 3,500 Cuban refugees.
Those of us who have been here for a generation or six or eight generations ought to have just as open a heart to receive the new refugees as our ancestors were received in the past.
But this temporary open arms policy has its own problems. No one knows how many Cubans will be coming to Florida. 25,000
has been suggested. By mid-May, Carter had put a halt on private boats leaving Florida and returning with refugees. This wasn't all just because of negative news stories. At this point, more than 40,000 Cubans had arrived in Florida. About 1,000 people were arriving daily.
But, as Mike Bustamante explains, the experience of Mariel had become a turning point in U.S. immigration history.
This is the era of growing fatigue in the United States with regard to immigration policy and politics. You know, this comes on the heels of, Vietnamese boat people. It coincides with an important wave of Haitian refugees as well. This is the beginning of sort of the rise of the modern-day anti-immigrant movement. It's no mistake that some of the most ardent kind of anti-immigrant NGOs and organizations that are still active today on the fronts of the Build a Wall campaigns and things like that, they're founded in the late 1970s. And so the Mariel refugees, you know, they're coming from Cuba. They are racially more diverse.
Only recently, scholars have started to pay more attention to the huge role that race played in the events surrounding the Mariel boat lift.
Right, because many of the people who left during Mariel were young, single Black men. A number of those Black Cubans ended up in Wisconsin.
Again, Lillian Guerra.
So 70.2% of the people who leave in 1980 are male. 92% are working class. And up to 40% are non-white. They are mulatto or they are Black. And so what you have in this is you have the three pillars. The people who were supposedly the most faithful and loyal to the revolution were Blacks, proletarians, and young people.
As the boat lift entered late May and early June 1980, that's when people who were in prison or psychiatric hospitals began arriving in the U.S.
In this group of Mariel refugees, you start seeing more Black Cubans, people who don't have family, friends, or networks in the United States. And once again, race is at play.
I've never seen evidence that there was a purposeful expulsion of Black Cubans per se. But to the extent that the Cuban government took advantage of this moment to send to the port of Mariel some folks who had been in prison and some folks who had been in psychiatric institutions of one kind or another, you know, there are ways in which, notwithstanding the revolution's advances on fronts of racial equality, for example, that patterns of exclusion in Cuban society still reflected structural racism that, guess what, you know, unsurprisingly proved more difficult to root out than, you know, just declaring that it be so. They were not good citizens of revolutionary Cuba, that they were ungrateful, in fact, of all that the revolution offered them, you know, in terms of path to education and upward mobility. But there is a racialized subtext to it in a way that seems anything but progressive and leftist. It seems rather racist and rather reactionary.
They already knew how difficult it was to be Black in Cuba. Now, they're about to learn how hard it is to be Black in the United States.
Some people, like Ernesto Rodriguez, knew early on that being Black in the U.S. would be a challenge. Remember earlier when he said he kissed the ground as he got off the boat on the shores of Key West? Well, there's more to that story.
When I got to Key West, the sooner I get out the boat, I kissed the ground and thank you, God.
Were you just happy to be on land, or were you happy to be in the U.S.?
I was happy to be in land, not in USA, because I don't want to come over here.
Oh, that's right. You wanted to be in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, because I hear in Cuba, the only thing you can see in Cuba is how bad is America. The Ku Klux Klan or the Black people not live okay here. And I was scared because I see all this stuff in Cuba. I don't want to go there. It's better here. And I go to another place worse. No, I don't want to go there. But we got lucky because we came here.
Remember, when the Cubans landed on U.S. soil, they had to find family or sponsors, a U.S. citizen or an organization who's supposed to vouch for the refugee and help them get started in their new country. For example, Edne didn't have much of a say where he'd ended up, because he didn't have family here or a sponsor right away. This was the case for many Black Cubans who arrived as part of the Mariel boat lift. Here's Michael Bustamante.
You have Mariel refugees who arrive in Key West and who, you know, very, you know, relatively quickly are sponsored by family members who are waiting for them, are allowed to integrate into the community, and therefore, you know, have an incredible leg up.
The refugees don't wait alone. Hundreds of their relatives waited for hours for the process to be completed. Emotions peak as names are called out and refugees are reunited with family and friends, while others try to catch glimpses of family members they haven't seen for 20 years.
Do the refugees seem to be haggard?
And then you have people who come, you know, frankly, of all races, who are, you know, don't have family members, and they have to seek sponsors. And so it stands to reason that in the United States of 1980, right, the Cubans who are Cubans of color are going to find more difficult time finding sponsors, you know, particularly when they are kind of sent away from South Florida.
People like Ernesto Rodriguez, Osvaldo Durruti, and Rodosvaldo Pozo, or Nino, were all alone on the shores of Florida.
How did you feel then when you landed in Key West? Were you excited? Were you scared, confused?
Yeah, I was free when I see everything. I said, oh my God, I can't believe it.
Mm-hmm. I was not with the family, I was alone, you know. But, you know, there were families that came from the street, but the people that I knew, we all came, you know, from penitentiary, you know, and we all were singles, and we say, well, whatever happened, you know, we gotta go.
If your family was waiting for you at Key West and opening their home to you, you were fine. If there was a volunteer organization that found you housing right away, you were fine. But then at one moment, things get out of hand. They run out of space for people.
So while these refugees waited to find sponsors, the U.S. government started sending them to remote military bases for processing. Fort Chaffee in Arkansas, Fort Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania, Eglin Air Force Base in the Florida Panhandle, and Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin.
And Fort McCoy was actually the last camp to be open. So what we see is the population of the last waves of Mariel refugees coming in, a population that is like 90% or 95% Black, single male, between the ages of 25 and 30 years old.
And it's Fort McCoy where the U.S. government sent people like Osvaldo, Nino, Armando, and Erne after they landed in South Florida. In the next episode of Uprooted...
There was a big plane. He said, get in there. Will you get in the plane? I don't know where we was.
They didn't tell you.
They not tell me where they're going to take me.
This group will go to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin. If they prove to be criminals...
The Cuban refugees begin their lives as Wisconsinites after arriving at Fort McCoy.
No air conditioning, no window screens for mosquitoes, no real insulation. These things would have been interesting to live in the middle of Wisconsin summer and then in the middle of Wisconsin fall.
And as they wait for their release, they find jobs on the base.
Well, I used to run a lot, play car, play baseball and then music.
And they also need to watch their backs.
Uprooted is reported, written, and produced by me, executive producer Maureen McCollum, along with Omar Granados. Our producer and technical director is Brad Kohlberg. We're edited by Brady Carlson. Music direction and composition by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich, Peter Bryant, Hannah Haynes, and Ezra Wall. Voice work by Michelle Good. Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand. The digital design team is Jane Jumale, Amanda Starich, and Anna Rudin. Digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. And special thanks to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse's Murphy Library for archival photos. Artwork by Grace Lorenz. Our theme music is the song Bozo Part 3 by Willie Chirino. Additional music from La Familia Valera Miranda. Archival audio from NPR's Research Archives and Data Strategy team. You can see more at wpr.org/uprooted.